Welcome to Southern Living on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Leslie Hunt. I'm your volunteer broadcaster. I will be reading from the Southern Living magazine, the August 2026 edition. I've got some great stories and good eats to read to you about. So if you're ready, let's get going. Our first article is entitled Queen City of the Gulf. With porch-lined streets, historic homes, and coastal soul, Galveston is a timeless Texas gem. This is written by Caitlin Yarborough Sadek. The feeling is incandescent. With a resounding pop, a balloon bursts beneath the sharp pinch of a dart, and I squeal with childlike giddiness. The less than impressed booth attendant hands me a giant plush pirate monkey, which I later place on my hotel bed like a trophy. Never before having won more than a paltry better luck next time, I cradled my spoils with a stupid grin plastered on my face for the rest of the evening spent along the Galveston Island Historic Pleasure Pier, an enduring landmark on Texas's Gulf Coast. That's how Galveston feels, a bit like going back to a beach trip of your youth, one of melting ice cream and sunburned meltdowns, cheap thrills and flip-flop clad dinners. It's a place of simple pleasures. Downtown's main drag was once nicknamed the Wall Street of the South due to its lively port that opened up the state's seaboard to fortune seekers and traders, as well as occasional pirate brigades. Victorian mansions still preside as reminders of the coastal hub's fleeting golden age before the historic 1900 hurricane devastated this sliver of an island, leaving behind a wake of destruction that took decades to repair. What remained was humbler fishermen on hard-working day boats, candy-colored motels on the beachfront, and the distinction of being a cherished spot where Texans could behold the sea and dip their toes in the waves. A popular vacation destination for generations of families, especially those hailing from around an hour away in Houston, the Queen City of the Gulf has settled into its more nostalgic roots. With a scenic seawall to protect its sun-drenched shores, Galveston now swells with everything that makes summer an ageless delight. Dock to table. It's already balmy out as I watch fishermen toss their morning catches from one bin to another at Katie's Seafood Market, which backs up to a dock for quick transfers. I see these bounties flying in rhythmic succession from the swaying deck to a cleaning table and then to the store's large display ice beds, fishmongers dealing with their customers all the while. Buddy Gwendon, a career fisherman who's lived in Galveston nearly 50 years, started the market in 1998 alongside his wife Katie and his brother Kenny. It felt like the next step, he remembers. The first red snapper I ever sold when I was 15 years old was right on this pier. The shop provides these goods next door to their restaurant, Katie's Seafood House, the only fully self-supplied boat-to-plate eatery on the island. Everything on the menu is made with whatever is brought in that day. We don't serve anything that's not on the absolute freshest you can get, says Buddy, whose four sons have continued his legacy either working on local fishing boats or managing the family businesses. I care deeply about where it's coming from. During his tenure here, the area has endured bouts of severe overfishing, leading him to advocate for more sustainable practices. He's even traveled to Washington, D.C. on multiple occasions to speak on the matter. The region has seen real benefits from future-minded regulations, such as catch shares. The city's maritime heritage traces back more than 200 years to when the port was first established, making it the oldest in Texas. The slender island, about 3 miles across at its widest point, is flanked by warm Gulf waters and a brackish bay, which hold an abundance of native species such as grouper, red snapper, and shrimp. It's still bustling with boats that weave in and out with their scaly wares, providing for the state's culinary scene plus grocery store seafood counters, including H-E-B, and other nearby spots blessed with proximity. For the past 115 years, Guido's has been cooking up these coastal delicacies. Opened in 1911 by Italian immigrant San Giacinto Cinto Guido as a sandwich shop, it evolved into a fine dining establishment that lures people from all over the state to book a table at this legendary, still carpeted space. Following four generations of stewardship, Nick Guido and his wife, Caterina, now run the business. My grandfather always told us to find out what the customer wants and serve it, says Nick, who started out peeling shrimp for his father when he was 12. We try to stick to that every day. The old school menu features seafood dishes topped gratuitously with lump crab and crawfish, including its signature American red snapper, Michael. Between bites of my Beurre Blanc covered filet, I watch families toast to birthdays and graduations over plates of crustless pecan pie drizzled decadently in bourbon sauce, another longtime menu staple. In 2025, the James Beard Foundation awarded Guido's an America's Classics designation, solidifying its status as an icon of Lone Star State cuisine. It's really a credit to the thousands of employees we've had over the decades who have dedicated themselves to the restaurant, says Nick. And it's great to still see three generations of guests all sitting together at our tables. Afterward, we hit another popular local haunt, sipping nightcaps on the balcony at the Poop Deck, a roguishly named dive bar that dubs itself as Where the Elite Meet in Bare Feet. On this night, a regular is celebrating her 70th birthday, bedecked in a gown and sash, and we clink beer bottles with her as the sun slowly disappears over the horizon. A grand tour. As I trudge through the humidity in the East End Historic District, glimpses of its heyday are evident, if a bit more muted by age. While aerial views of the island are flashes of blue-green waters and flat beige beaches, inland is clad in colorful clapboard homes and remnants of its former glory. Victorian mansions that survived great storms and eras of change take up whole blocks, colossal buildings with stained glass windows and towering turrets. Many are private residences, which can be entered only during special public home tours, while a few have transformed into cultural anchors. Both the Moody Mansion and the 1892 Bishop's Palace are museums stilled in time and filled with the marks of late 19th century splendor. My shoes squeak on gleaming dark wood floors as my eyes catch the richly hued walls and gilded candelabras. At Moody Mansion, an original 1800s wooden passenger elevator, one of the few of its kind left in the state, remains in working order for visitors requiring assistance. It stands as a perfect example of how thoughtful preservation can honor the past while quietly serving the needs of the present, said Catherine Pickavance, manager of guest operations. The Bryan Museum, housed in a 20,000-square-foot former orphanage, offers an unexpected lesson in Texas history. It has one of the largest collections of American West artifacts, covering more than 12,000 years. See Native American tools, Spanish colonial documents, works of art, and innumerable other treasures. I marvel at the centuries-old ornate saddles coated in authentic gold that are displayed in the same room as a trio of rare 1986 Andy Warhol paintings. More conspicuous to the eye, the Grand Galvez Hotel acted as a beacon of bubblegum pink renewal in the wake of the devastating 1900 hurricane. The 115-year-old structure completed a major renovation in 2023, and the imposing landmark of Spanish colonial revival architecture continues a tradition of attracting guests with sweeping Gulf views. A newer addition to the stretch of coastal accommodations, Hotel Lucene, is a trendy departure from the norm. Previously a 1960s motor lodge, it's been reimagined by hospitality experts Keith and Dave Jacoby, who took it from being a botched reno property to one that feels mid-century cool. a speckling of sun-faded inns and no-fuss lodgings plus two high-demand cabins at Galveston Island State Park make it possible to bed down just steps from the water. However, I found that where you stay doesn't seem to matter very much. Even in the scorching Texas heat, people aren't inside. They're nestled in the sand, watching out for the Gulf dolphins that bob in the distant waves. They're letting ice cream cones drip all over their hands and sunscreen slip into their eyes. They're winning stuffed animals at the pier and sinking right into summer. End of story. Our next article is a continuation of one that I started last week called Southern Food Hall of Fame. We asked our readers to name their essentials, and these 50 products topped the list. This was written by Alana Al-Hatlani and Josh Miller. So we left off about halfway through the list, and I'm going to start here with some hot sauce, heated rivalry. Louisiana knows a thing or two about hot sauce. This is number 31, Crystal Hot Sauce, New Orleans, Louisiana. Prized for its peppery but well-balanced appeal, it's ideal for oysters and gumbo. Number 32, Louisiana Hot Sauce, New Iberia, Louisiana. It's bright and vinegary, so it cuts through the richness of fried foods. And 33, Tabasco Sauce, Avery Island, Louisiana. Packing just the right amount of heat and featuring a signature tang, it's long been a mainstay in home pantries and restaurants. On to shop local, what we always grab at the store. Number 34 is Rosses Markets, Mouthy's Creole Cream Cheese, Houma, Louisiana. The Louisiana-born grocery stores with Alabama and Mississippi locations, too, sell regional specialties like this Creole cream cheese from Mathieu Farms in Mississippi. Number 35, Publix Key Lime Pie, Winter Haven, Florida. The bakery department of this chain holds a special place in many Southerners' hearts, but the key lime pie with the unique addition of toasted almonds really sets it apart. Number 36, H-E-B Tortillas, Caravel, Texas. Soft and fluffy with a buttery taste, the tortillas made fresh by this grocery are so revered that homesick former Texans are known to get them shipped to their new addresses. Next section gets saucy, starting with number 37, Stubbs Barbecue Sauce, Lubbock, Texas. The friendly face on this bottle is Christopher B. Stubb Stubblefield, a mess sergeant and two-time Purple Heart recipient during the Korean War. He began crafting his signature recipe while enlisted, opening a restaurant after returning home to Lubbock. The original location closed, but Stubbs Barbecue still has an Austin outpost. In 1991, he introduced the country to his sauce on Late Night with David Letterman. Now it's carried in stores nationwide. Next up, number 38, Georgia Soul Barbecue Sauce, St. Simons Island, Georgia. Our readers rave about Southern Soul Barbecue, naming it one of the South's best year after year, but you don't have to travel to enjoy its sweet Georgia Soul sauce. Number 39, Big Bob Gibson Barbecue White Sauce, Decatur, Alabama. Although their original white sauce was created in 1925, the tangy vinegar and mayo concoction gained more prominence when it was bottled in the 1990s. Number 40, Texas Pete Pepper Sauce, Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Southerners know that this mix of green Tabasco peppers, vinegar, and salt is the key to the best collards. Despite the brand's name, it actually comes from the Tar Heel State, not Texas. Number 41, Bone Suckin' Sauce, Raleigh, North Carolina. Founder Phil Ford initially set out to recreate his mother's Western North Carolina-style sauce, and the recipe was such a huge hit that it's now stocked all over the country. Make a pit stop. There's several that fit this title. Number 42, Goo Goo Cluster Candy, Nashville, Tennessee. Number 43, Moon Pie, Chattanooga, Tennessee. Number 44, Zapp's Potato Chips, Gramercy, Louisiana. Number 45, Golden Flake Chips, Birmingham, Alabama. And number 46, Bluebell Ice Cream, Brenham, Texas. Under Bucky's Beaver Nuggets, Lake Jackson, Texas, don't let the name intimidate you. This road trip snack is worth pulling over for. The caramel-coated corn puffs are a staple of Bucky's, a gas station giant that was established in 1982 in the Lone Star State and is rapidly expanding to every corner of the South. Number 48, Pecan Log Roll, Eastman, Georgia. Georgia pecan farmer William Sylvester Stuckey's eponymous gas station stores may have evolved from a simple roadside stand on US 23, but his wife Ethel came up with and perfected its most famous item, the pecan log. Caramel nougat and pecans combine to make a sweet and crunchy candy that travelers still seek out decades later. Number 49, Lance Peanut Butter Crackers, Charlotte, North Carolina. What do you do with 500 pounds of surplus peanuts? If you're Philip L. Lance, you roast them and sell them by the bag. Peanut butter was a later addition, but the real magic happened when his wife and daughters layered the spread between two crackers, creating what would become a favorite after-school bite. And last but not least, number 50, Little Debbie Snack Cakes, Chattanooga, Tennessee. Named for founder Othur Doris O.D. McKee's granddaughter, this iconic sweets company was conceived while he was selling another bakery's 5-cent cakes out of the back of his car in the 1930s. He soon developed his own recipe for soft oatmeal sandwich cookies, which he called cream pies. But it wasn't until after he built a plant in nearby Collegedale in the 1950s that classics like Nutty Buddy Bars and Swiss Rolls hit the scene. And that is the end of the story. You are listening to Southern Living on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Leslie Hunt, your volunteer broadcaster. Continuing on, our next article is entitled The Magic Power of Okra. Unlock its secrets and the possibilities are endless. This was written by Trelawney Michelle. Okra just might be the most misunderstood plant in the southern garden. As a child in Monroe, Louisiana, I only liked it battered and fried crunchy enough to make me forget the slime. In New Orleans, I grew up on seafood gumbo where the okra disappeared into the broth. On the sidelines of parade routes waiting for the next Mardi Gras float, I discovered that okra, marinated in vinegar with garlic, peppers, and dill, could taste just as good, if not better, than a sour pickle. I thought I understood this iconic veggie, good fried, better pickled, and tolerable when cooked down so completely that it barely registered. Then a bowl of okra and tomatoes changed my mind. Knowing there were still likely a trace of slime, I hesitated, then took a bite, and I haven't stopped eating it since. Okra carries flavor beautifully and doesn't require much seasoning to do its job. You can maintain its natural crispness or stew it down till it's as soft as a bell pepper in soup, and it'll still hold its own. In the South, tasting okra felt like discovering a bridge across the ocean, says Chef Ade Karena, a native of Benin, now living in Durham, North Carolina. Long before it rooted itself in southern soil, okra journeyed from its birthplace in East Africa, spreading north and west across the continent, later reaching the Middle East and South Asia. Arriving in the Americas around the 17th century through the transatlantic slave trade, okra became a mainstay in the region. In its earliest days, here it grew in provisional gardens of enslaved communities and was used in adapted Western African dishes like gumbo and okra soup. Most of its misunderstanding is due to its mucilage, which I'd only ever heard it called slime. It's not slimy, Karena explains. It pulls. That pull, a soluble fiber that thickens soups and stews, can be tamed or cooked out completely, depending on how you treat it. The more you slice into it, the more it pulls. Keep it intact or cook it quickly, and the effect lessens. Like the South, okra takes time to be fully experienced and appreciated. You can't visit one state and think you've seen or tasted all its glory. You must explore as many of its offerings as your palate permits. Then, as my grandma preached, go at it again after your taste has evolved. It wasn't until I crossed the bridge from Savannah to South Carolina and drove for less than the runtime of an album to arrive in Charleston that this vegetable became my hands-down favorite. In one pot, Perlues, where rice mingles grain for grain with protein and okra, I tasted West African before I had ever set foot there. Seeing the pickled veggie from my childhood atop a pan seared black drum at a white tablecloth restaurant made me proud. Dehydrated okra with a pinch of salt became my favorite chip. Then biting into a fresh pod from my own backyard, no cooking, no seasoning, emphasized its versatility even more. From a survival food to a staple in kitchens across the country, okra's evolution is reflected in the following recipes. Blistered okra with peanut sauce, a nod to the groundnut stews and sauces central to West African cooking. Fried okra BLTs, featuring a preparation method long perfected and beloved from Cameroon to the American South. New Orleans barbecue shrimp and okra, marrying two classics in a city that helped cement the vegetable's place in our nation's cuisine. And pickled okra and field pea soup, honoring the preservation techniques that sustained earlier generations. Trelawney Michelle specializes in Gullah Geechee traditions with over a decade of storytelling experience. She explores the historical and contemporary significance of Black Southern foodways. I'm going to give you one recipe out of the several she mentioned, and it's the New Orleans barbecue shrimp and okra. Be sure to leave the shells on the shrimp during cooking to keep them from drying out. Active time 35 minutes, total time 45. This serves four. You will need the following ingredients. 1.5 pound jumbo unpeeled raw shrimp, 2 tablespoons canola oil, 8 ounces large fresh okra untrimmed and halved lengthwise, 1 teaspoon Cajun seasoning, 1/2 cup cold unsalted butter cut into pieces, divided, 4 garlic cloves finely chopped, about 4 teaspoons, 2 tablespoons hot sauce, preferably the original Louisiana brand hot sauce, 3/4 teaspoon black pepper, 1 1/4 cups unsalted chicken broth, 1/2 cup Worcestershire sauce, 3 tablespoons fresh lemon juice from 1 lemon, and 4 5-inch thyme sprigs plus more leaves for garnish. Here are the steps. Cut down the back of each shrimp shell lengthwise using small scissors. Discard vein. Do not remove the shell. Set aside. Number 2. Heat oil in a large skillet over medium-high until shimmering. Add okra. Cut sides down and sprinkle evenly with Cajun seasoning. Cook undisturbed until browned, 5 to 7 minutes. Transfer okra to a plate. Do not wipe the skillet clean. Number 3, melt 2 tablespoons of the butter in skillet over medium high, stirring constantly until foam subsides, about 30 seconds. Add the garlic, hot sauce, and black pepper. Cook, stirring constantly until fragrant and hot sauce is almost evaporated, about 1 minute. Add chicken broth, Worcestershire sauce, lemon juice, and thyme sprigs. Bring to a vigorous simmer over medium high and simmer, stirring occasionally until flavors meld and sauce thickens slightly to a spoon, 10 to 12 minutes. Number 4, add shrimp to sauce and skillet. Cook, stirring often until shrimp are pink and just cook through, about 4 minutes. Turn off heat. Add the remaining 6 tablespoons of butter, stirring until melted and sauce is emulsified, 1 to 2 minutes. Return okra to skillet and stir until combined. Garnish with more thyme leaves and serve. End of story. To the kitchen section of the magazine, yes, you can cook less this summer. Beat the heat with 3 effortless techniques. The first one is pickled corn relish. Active time to make 20 minutes, total time 50 minutes plus 12 hours chilling. This serves 12. Bring 1 cup of white wine vinegar, 1/2 cup of water, 1/2 cup of sugar, and 2 teaspoons each, salt and mustard seeds, and 1/2 teaspoon each, celery seeds and ground turmeric to a boil in a medium saucepan. Stir in 2 cups fresh corn kernels, 3/4 cup each finely chopped red bell pepper and red onion, and 1/2 cup diced celery, removed from heat. Divide between 2 1-pint jars, let cool 30 minutes, cover and chill 12 hours. Serve over cream cheese with crackers if desired, and use as a relish. Or you can make it a dinner item by taking the relish and stir it into cooked pasta with Boursin cheese and bacon, which will give you a wonderful pasta dish. Our next one is marinated tomatoes. Active time to prep, 15 minutes. Total time cook, 45 minutes. Serves 12. Whisk together 1/3 cup red wine vinegar, 3 tablespoons olive oil, 3 tablespoons honey, 1 1/2 teaspoons salt, 1/2 teaspoon each black pepper and crushed red pepper, and 2 sliced garlic cloves in a bowl. Stir in 4 cups halved cherry tomatoes and 1/4 cup sliced scallions. Chill 30 minutes, drain. To serve, spread 2 8-ounce containers of whipped cream cheese on a plate, top with tomatoes, and then top with basil, serve with crackers, again as an appetizer. Or if you wanted to make this for dinner, toss rotisserie chicken in with the marinated tomatoes and mozzarella and serve as a main dish. End of story. Well, that wraps it up for our show today. This is Leslie Hunt, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading the Sun Living magazine for August 2026. Stay tuned for our next show, East Valley News.